From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the bipartisan commission reviewing the attacks of 9/11 concluded its exhaustive investigations. Over the last few months, it has combed through thousands of documents and interviewed many civilians, military personnel, and administration officials. On Wednesday, it weighed in on one of the most hotly contested issues surrounding the war in Iraq, namely the alleged relationship between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. This is what they said.
Two senior bin Laden associates have adamantly denied any ties existed between al-Qaeda and Iraq. And so far, we have no credible evidence that Iraq and al-Qaeda cooperated on attacks against the United States.
So that's it then. Finally, an end to months of dispute over this issue.
Well, not quite. The next day, in a press conference, the president gave this response when asked why he kept insisting there was a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
The reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda, because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Apparently, you can drive a stake into the heart of this story, but you just can't kill it. Again and again, the misperception that there were ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda has been struck down, and again, it keeps coming back. Standard journalistic practice dictates that when a statement comes from the administration, it will be in the lead of the story and at the top of every broadcast, as this latest statement was. And with that, a dead assertion is once again resurrected. Christy Harvey compiles the Progress Report for the Center for American Progress, a liberal Washington-based think tank. She's been following the course of this misperception. Christy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
First of all, let's do, as your column was titled on Wednesday, An Anatomy of This Myth. Take us through some of the statements by people telling us over the last year or so that there was no tie between al-Qaeda and Iraq.
The administration's own weapons inspector, David Kaye, said they'd been on the ground for months, and he said they simply did not find any real links at all. The CIA director, George Tenet, stated earlier this year in front of the Senate that he did not suggest there was any operational direction or control by Iraq with al-Qaeda. The Carnegie Endowment for Peace said there was no proof that there was any solid evidence. The UN group that was looking into it also came up blank. So over and over, all of these different intelligence groups have shot down the claim and said that there just is no proof. But the problem is the perception gets into the public mind that it is true. And proof positive of this is a majority of Americans honestly believe that there is a link between Saddam and 9/11. 45% in a poll that was taken last April thought that there was definitive proof, thought that there was actually evidence that had been found. The study had been done by the Program on International Policy and Attitudes, and they said it was the most striking misperception that they had found about the war in Iraq.
What did you think on Thursday when the president seemed to be both acknowledging that there was no direct evidence and yet reiterating that there was a connection?
Well, President Bush and the rest of the administration right now is trying to deflect attention away from the finding of the 9/11 Commission that there is no evidence of a connection by making this a battle of words. They've gone from saying that there was a relationship to saying that there was contact. Monday, Vice President Cheney claimed that Hussein, quote, had long established ties with al-Qaeda, and President Bush backed him up the very next day. President Bush said, quote, there's no question that Saddam and al-Qaeda had ties. He even said you can't distinguish between al-Qaeda and Saddam. But just because you say something over and over, it doesn't make it true.
Well, it's certainly true that the administration drumbeat was present and that there wasn't a whole lot of public argument by the major media outlets. The fact is, the reporting was all there. I mean, I certainly have been aware all this time that there was no connection. I never saw any evidence from the administration, and it hasn't been hard for me to come up with a judgment entirely opposite that of the majority of the American people. Can the media be put to blame for a public that's just insufficiently curious or skeptical?
I really think they can be put to blame for that. There are so many misperceptions and things to follow with the war in Iraq. You've got the WMD claims. You've got the al-Qaeda connection claims. You've got the Iraqis view the American forces as liberators and will greet them with sweets and flowers claims. There's so much out there that there is a need for journalists to more aggressively follow up with the administration and hold the administration's feet to the fire when they are making these misstatements. But in the 24-hour news cycle, there are so many places to get bits and pieces of news. And so often, commentators have taken the place of hard news and objective journalism. You have Fox News and you have the talking head shows, and those are all well and good, but you have to get your diet of hard news as well. And I think all too often people are looking to just back up what they already believe.
Let me invoke a quotation from Sir Walter Scott that we heard a lot around 35 years ago in the midst of Watergate. "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." Is it possible that the administration's strategy of constant repetition of unsupportable arguments will eventually come back to haunt them in the thick of this re-election campaign?
Absolutely. They have repeated these claims so often that they have to keep repeating them now or else they'll be caught in lies or deception. And even if they're very careful with their language, so they can come back and say, well, we said contact, we didn't mean connection. It's going to come back and it's going to hurt them in the end. It's just a question of when.
All right, Christy. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Christy Harvey is Deputy Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank based in Washington, D.C.
While the argument inexplicably persists over ties between al-Qaeda and Saddam, the terrorist network continues to reach out and touch people on the internet. It's a phenomenon that's difficult to trace, even to locate, for non-Arabic-speaking Westerners, but it's nonetheless thriving. In Wednesday's issue of Slate, Radio Free Europe analyst Daniel Kimmage provided a peek at the so-called jihadist internet and one particularly disturbing website, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello, nice to be here.
So as you wrote, these pro-Al-Qaeda websites aren't so easy to find in cyberspace.
Well, some of them move addresses frequently because they're tracked, they get shut down. The internet carrier will simply say, we don't want to host a site with incitement to commit acts of terrorism. We don't want to host a site with graphic, gruesome images of mutilated bodies. We simply don't want to be hosting this sort of material.
Would you walk us through some of these pro-Al-Qaeda websites? What do they look like?
They look like your average web forum. In other words, there are postings and there are threads. In some cases, they use the same internet templates, so they look just like a forum that would be discussing travel. There may be a section that will be the political section, then the Islamic law section, then the current events section, maybe an electronic jihad section, and then a literature section, so there'll be poetry.
One entry that was posted in an al-Qaeda online forum was a detailed description of attack on non-Muslims and Westerners in Saudi Arabia by the author who called himself Fawaz bin Muhammad al-Nashmi. What struck you about that?
Well, first of all, that it's an insider's account of an attack, but of course there's the very important caveat that this may not have happened the way he said. And the way that I was looking at this is as an insight into the ideology and the recruiting, because these forums are not where they exchange operational information, but it's where they air the ideas that serve as a recruiting tool. And what struck me about this is that it's a heroic, epic account very clearly meant to inspire others.
Here's some quotes that you cite in your piece. "I shot him in the head and his head exploded. I saw the skull of the soldier behind the machine gun explode before me." That's when they were battling security forces.
And there's a car chase where they run six checkpoints. There's a point where they're driving along the highway in a pickup truck with someone crouched in the back. These are images almost from a Hollywood blockbuster. And what's fascinating about these accounts is you have to remember they're pitched to an audience that would be very familiar with Hollywood blockbusters, perhaps. And they combine a religious discourse, a political discourse, and these very gripping moments of action. So they're savvy in that they understand the power of the images and they understand the audience they're pitching it to.
What about the vocabulary used by al-Nashmi and his fellow jihadist web users? You make a point of describing the recurrence of certain words and how they would resonate.
Well, in this account, this is, of course, a real terror attack that occurred in Saudi Arabia. And the vocabulary that he uses is very carefully chosen to evoke not only Saudi Arabia, but also Israel and also Iraq, which are the two great flashpoints, of course. So he evokes the images of the occupied territories with the words settlements and checkpoints, and he evokes images of Iraq with the use of the words Humvees and Marines. So in a sense, this action unfolds in an almost this virtual landscape of global jihad.
So what do narratives like al-Nashmi's tell us about the ideology? What sorts of lessons are there for us in these websites?
What they can tell us is that the ideas are specific ideas. Many, many op-eds and articles say it's a battle of hearts and minds. Well, what exactly are the ideas that are winning people's minds? In these texts, they see themselves as the victims of a worldwide plot sponsored by the United States, acting in concert with Israel, to destroy their very identity and civilization. And they have a way of fighting this. They see Afghanistan and the Mujahideen fight against the Soviet Union as proof that a small group of dedicated holy warriors can bring down a mighty empire. They would like to repeat this with the United States. In these forums, this is where they are building their ideology. It's almost as though it's an open source ideology, a sort of revolutionary jihadist Linux, where people are putting it together.
Should we be more worried about these websites than we are? I mean, we're hardly aware of them.
As for the actual websites, I'm not sure that I would blame the medium here for the message. I think that it may be in some cases a good thing that we can look and analyze. It is the ideology in these websites that, of course, is worrisome. It's very frightening for everyone. It's terribly frightening for the Muslim and Arab world. It's frightening for America. This is a threat that I think affects all of us.
Daniel Kimmage, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Kimmage is the Central Asian analyst for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He also writes about the Middle East and the ideology of jihad.
Coming up, in Italy, a journalist quits her job and joins the European Parliament. And in Arizona, investigative reporters forsake competition to avenge a murder.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, nearly 15,000 candidates vied for seats in the European Parliament, the first election since the EU's eastward expansion in May. Votes in the UK and the Netherlands were cast earlier this month. Italy's elections for 78 of the 732 parliament seats were held last weekend. And what an upset there was. Television journalist Lily Gruber won the day, fetching more votes in the districts where she ran than the party of Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister and media mogul. Gruber exulted, "I beat the master of TV." Sylvia Poggioli is NPR's senior European correspondent and the master of radio, and she joins me from Rome. Sylvia, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
I must say, this European parliamentary politics is very confusing for me. I guess the short question is, what is this parliament? What effect does it have on Europe and on Italy in particular?
You're not the only one who's confused by the European Parliament. That's why so few people went to vote. Nobody really understands what goes on in Brussels, even though many, many laws of the various countries originate in Brussels, even though it is very important and increasingly so. What was interesting about the results of the Italian election is what it says about the popularity at this moment of the governing coalition of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
Berlusconi's party, Forza Italia, suffered a significant defeat, and Lily Gruber, who ran for the Olive Tree Coalition, beat Berlusconi with twice the number of votes. What happened?
Well, it's a really unusual thing in this country where Berlusconi controls, either directly through ownership or from his position as prime minister, 90% of the TV broadcast media in the country. He was defeated by a TV personality which his own TV networks did not show on TV for the whole campaign. She disappeared. She was never present on the news. You would have never known she was a candidate if you had followed the state TV and the Berlusconi-owned TV. On the contrary, Berlusconi himself was on the air, especially in the last week, constantly. What happened is Lily Gruber is probably one of the most respected anchors and journalists because she covered almost single-handedly for her network the entire war in Iraq last year. She was there for many, many months. And she's a very highly respected journalist. It's a big loss of image and prestige for the prime minister.
What actually does it mean that he has no seat himself, the prime minister of Italy, in the European Parliament?
No. He won his seat because he was on a slate everywhere in a different party. In any case, there's a rule that the prime minister or ministers serving in the Italian parliament cannot hold dual representation. Therefore, he will hand over his votes or whatever to the next in line. But in the same areas where they were both running, she beat him.
Now, this was not Lily Gruber's first confrontation with Prime Minister Berlusconi. She resigned from the state broadcaster Rai after criticizing his influence in the media.
She was very angry at the way the news was produced on her own program, the kind of things she was told to read. She also was very upset when Freedom House, the New York-based think tank, downgraded Italian media from free to partly free, which put Italy on a par with Turkey. She and many other Italians were very angry at the media law, which Berlusconi's government was able to pass. It's a new law which gives him even more control of the media.
How did Berlusconi react to the results from the polling?
Well, we don't know, because if you look at television, we didn't see his face. We didn't hear any direct comments, at least on the first, 24 hours after the election results were coming in. He had other members of his party take the flak. The only statement that was released was that he was taking responsibility for his party's poor showing. But he is determined to continue with the economic reforms that he's promised him 3 years ago, but that he has not yet delivered on.
Berlusconi did something very unusual, I guess it's a media story. He used, or the government used, people's cell phones, the SMS function, the text messaging function, to notify them when the polls were open, which Gruber was very disturbed with. Tell me about it.
The entire opposition was very upset by that. Yes, it was unusual. It's never happened before. The Italian law has it that any kind of propaganda, campaigning, rallies have to stop 24 hours before the polls open. And all of a sudden, during the night, everybody in Italy, I think every cell phone imaginable got these little buzzes and announcements that they got a message. And in it, it was the prime minister's office urging all Italians to go out and vote. But that's not all he did. The very afternoon he went to vote, it was Saturday, I believe, as he came out of his polling station, he started holding a rally in front of the TV cameras, urging everybody to vote for his party. This is also against the law. No kind of electioneering should take place within, I don't know, something like a quarter of a mile of every polling station. But there in front of the TV cameras, he continued to urge voters to vote for his party. TV networks did not air that evening, aware that they probably would have had legal repercussions if it had
even his own and even the RAI?
Even his own. All the TV networks played it completely down and did not report what he had said.
Well, Sylvia, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Sylvia Poggioli is NPR's senior European correspondent. The definitive list of winners in the election will be out June 28th.
Telephone text messaging has finally caught on in America, lagging far behind Europe and Asia, where it's been used to investigate and even solve murders. Now, America has its first high-profile criminal case that may well hinge on text messaging, the trial of NBA star Kobe Bryant. It seems that a year ago, just hours after having sex with Bryant, the woman who has accused him of rape exchanged text messages with an ex-boyfriend and another person, still unidentified. Those messages could be, in the words of the judge, highly irrelevant in determining whether the sex was consensual or not. So the judge wants the cell phone company to produce the messages, and they can do it. Text messages, like emails, are stored on servers long after we press delete. Barry Steinhardt is the director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. Barry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So where does the law in the United States stand on retaining data for law enforcement purposes?
There is a law in the United States that requires that telephone companies or communications providers retain data. We're, of course, concerned about companies that are turning over data that they are retaining, whether it's email messages or text messages, without a court order, without giving the person who's the subject of those messages an opportunity to object.
In Kobe's case, the company was AT&T Wireless. And I guess last month, the state district judge in the case ordered that the messages be turned over to him for private review to determine whether or not they were relevant. This strikes you as improper or out of order?
No, I think in a criminal case, if a company has evidence, it's appropriate for a judge to review it. Really, the question with this sort of thing has been whether or not the government is going to force companies to retain data long beyond when they would retain it for business purposes in order to facilitate investigations down the line. There's been a major battle about that worldwide. Here in the United States so far, we have avoided those requirements, but they may yet be coming.
In this case, it could very well exonerate Kobe Bryant if he's innocent. In other cases in Europe, it's actually helped track criminals down. Is it such a bad thing to hold on to this material?
Well, you need to think about this from two perspectives. One, of course, is it's enormously expensive for the companies to hold on to this data. So you really are requiring them to rebuild at great expense. Secondly, we have to ask what kind of society we want to live in. Do we want to live in a society where our every communication or every utterance is tracked and correlated? After all, remember that a lot of the data that's being held onto may seem innocuous, but it may, for example, allow you to be physically tracked. That's what a cell phone call can do now. And we know that the government, particularly the federal government, has been abusing its ability to get access to this kind of data. That's likely to worsen if we simply increase the power that they have to surveil the data.
When you talk about abuse, are you talking about the loosening up of restrictions under the Patriot Act?
Patriot Act and similar kinds of legislation that have allowed them to go into service providers, whether they're electronic mail providers or telephone companies, and to get access to communications data without really any significant judicial oversight, without any notice to the party. Unfortunately, we're in a situation now where we have the worst of both worlds. We have both intrusive government and secret government. So we're not sure the full parameters of what's happened here, but we do know that they've used these new powers quite extensively.
Barry, we do have something called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
Yes, we do.
Doesn't that offer some protection?
Not as much as one might think, particularly because it treats different kinds of communications in different ways. So, for example, a voice telephone call in real time has greater protection under our laws than does stored email, when really in the modern world there is no great distinction. We now all are used to communicating through these other medium, but the law unfortunately treats them differently. It gives greater protection to some than to others.
I'm wondering what the impact of the Kobe Bryant case might be. We know that in Medford, Oregon, a man convicted of killing his wife had sent some email messages and text messages that were meant to terrorize her, and they played a role in his case. The AP is calling the Kobe Bryant example the first high-profile U.S. criminal case in which text messages could be entered into the docket.
Well, maybe it'll be. What I'm concerned about is the possibility that we'll begin to get calls now to require companies like AT&T Wireless to retain data for long periods of time under circumstances where the government in particular can get easy access to it based on nothing more than the hint of suspicion. The question is how much process is going to be involved here. Are we going to have, as we apparently are in this case, a judge who will review the data? There'll be an opportunity to contest the handover of the data. You'll have due process and ability to protect your interests and your rights. Unfortunately, the way the law is going in the United States, increasingly, there is no ability to protect your rights. The government simply has to make an assertion that it's somehow relevant to a crime or to a matter of national security, and they can get access to that data without your knowing it and without your having any ability to contest the handover.
Okay. Barry, thank you very much.
Okay, sure thing.
Barry Steinhardt is the director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the ACLU.
Last year, some 53 journalists died in the line of duty, 20 of them covering the war in Iraq. We're less accustomed to hearing about journalists in the United States dying on the job, but in June of 1976, Arizona Republic newspaper reporter Don Bowles, whose beat was organized crime, was killed in the middle of the day in downtown Phoenix. The following story, however, isn't about heroism in the line of duty. It's about a unique collaboration of dozens of investigative reporters from around the country who, drawn together by Bowles' murder, forgot that they were competitors and converged on Phoenix to finish his work. It was called the Arizona Project. From Phoenix, Steve Goldstein recounts the tale.
When Don Bowles' car was blown up on June 2, 1976, the explosion was recorded by an attorney who was dictating in his nearby office.
Stage would be to, for me to file.
Bowles died in a Phoenix hospital 11 days later, following a series of operations to amputate one arm and both legs. Bowles had investigated organized crime for the Arizona Republic for more than a decade and made some enemies. The Republic staff tried to fill Bowles' void, turning their shock and anger toward work. Bob Early was a city editor at the Republic and Don Bowles' boss.
When we found out that it was one of our guys, we mobilized the whole effort of reporting it. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to be shocked or to think about it.
Meanwhile, in Indianapolis, at the inaugural convention of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization, an unprecedented decision was made. The IRE would send a team to Arizona to follow up on Bowles' investigations. Newsday's Bob Green led the team. He says the reporters weren't going to try to solve Bowles' murder. Instead, they wanted to investigate and illuminate the conditions that led to it. They would try to use journalism as a weapon.
Here was a society that felt, at least some elements of it, felt it was permissible to kill a reporter to stop his work. Now, the question in our mind was to go out there and examine that society, particularly in light of what he had been working on.
Bob Early was glad the reporters were coming to Phoenix.
Any kind of show of strength, it seemed to me, would be beneficial for us so that these kind of things wouldn't happen again. The more heat that we could bring on to the criminal element as a result of this, and also, you know, to government and to politicians, would have been very beneficial to us.
Over the course of 6 months, 38 journalists worked on the project. Many of them had never met Bowles. Members teamed up to investigate the influence of organized crime in the state, from prostitution to illegal immigration to land fraud. Six of the team members were involved from start to finish, but most could only commit to a couple of weeks. So Bob Green developed a system of cross-indexed files that would let newer reporters get up to speed quickly. The group's efforts drew attention in Arizona, and it also sparked high-profile interest from the CBS News magazine, 60 Minutes.
When they blew up an Arizona reporter named Don Bowles, they may have blown up a lot more than they bargained for.
It also got the attention of rival newspapers. The New York Times and the Washington Post said the project was misguided at best. Bob Green.
New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, who I had great, great respect for, said if this is to be done, it shouldn't be done collectively. The New York Times will do it. The Times didn't do it, so fortunately we did. Ben Bradley in the Washington Post opposed it. First statement he made was that investigative reporters cannot sit in the same room for more than 3 days without going at each other's throats. It'll never work.
But it did work. On March 13, 1977, newspapers across the country published the first of a 23-part series produced by the Arizona Project team. It chronicled alleged corruption in Arizona business and politics. But none of those stories appeared in Don Bowles' paper. Nina Pulliam, publisher of the Arizona Republic, made the decision. Former city editor Bob Early says the paper should have published the series.
What our publisher at the time was concerned about was the fact that we were going to publish things that were in some tone accusatory, and so they were concerned about legal action. I didn't have any concerns about that.
I was outraged.
Again, Bob Green.
It was a newspaper that had been cooperating with us all the way along the line on the Bob Early level, which was the city editor level, and which all of a sudden now is saying they never had any part of the project.
Green wasn't alone in his anger. The general manager of local radio station KOY was stunned by the Republic's decision. So he decided the station should read the series on the air every night at 6:30 to keep Phoenix residents informed.
As a public service, KOY News now presents a comprehensive review of today's report by the Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. Since today is
As a reporter for the Indianapolis Star, Myrta Pulliam was part of the Arizona Project. She was affected professionally and personally by the Republic's decision not to publish the series. The publisher was her grandmother.
You know, if somebody kills a reporter, this is the kind of attention that's going to get turned on you. People from all over the country are going to come out here, and you're going to be put under a microscope. And no criminal, no person in their right mind wants that to happen to them. I think that that worked. The fact that we were all there, there was so much attention, really was an insurance policy and still is to this day.
The Arizona Project won a number of journalism awards and was nominated for a special Pulitzer Prize. Three men were convicted in the killing of Don Bowles. One died in 2002. Another was released from prison in 1998 and is free today. The third is still in jail, serving a life sentence in Arizona. For On the Media, I'm Steve Goldstein.
Coming up, one medium that liberals really do seem to control, for the moment, and why the National Rifle Association is now shooting into the air.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And welcome to hour number three of Cam and Company on NRAnews.com. And broadcasting live today, the big debut on Sirius, Channel 126.
Yeah, you heard correctly. That NRA. This week, the National Rifle Association went live on Sirius Satellite Radio with its daily talk show, previously available only over the web. The three-hour show consists of straightforward newscasts.
Miscommunication plagued the U.S. government's response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. The independent panel investigating...
Equally straightforward advocacy...
As violent crime rates went up, anti-gun schemes rained down. But the NRA fought back, defending the right to self-defense.
And plenty of pro-gun rights discussion, talk radio style. But the NRA says its media aspirations, which include plans to eventually buy actual radio stations, are as much about the First Amendment as the second one. By taking its show live now, the group claims it no longer is subject to pre-election spending limits for lobbying organizations laid out in the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Why? Because that law exempts newspapers, broadcasters, and other media outlets. And thus, says NRA Vice President Wayne LaPierre, the gun lobby now qualifies.
The government in our country doesn't hand out permission slips as to who's entitled to deliver news and information and who's not. In America, going back to Tom Paine and the pamphleteers, anyone has been entitled to deliver news and information. And this McCain-Feingold bill says that you can only do that if you're in the media business. Well, I'm telling NBC and ABC and CBS, the New York Times, we're all family now. We're in the media business, too.
I'm joined now by Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be with you.
I must say, much as I'd like to, I'm having trouble finding a hole in that argument. What about you?
I think he's overstating it when he says that the government does not decide what is the media, when in fact, in a number of contexts, the federal agencies do, and the courts have to decide whether they are in fact media. And there are some indicia of media that the courts have talked about in the past. really what we look at here is whether or not this acts like media in terms of being periodical. Are they going to continue to do this? And are they distributing it the way that media is normally distributed? Is this a series of political commercials, or is this really an attempt to put on a show with commentary in it? But I have to admit that it's becoming harder and harder to draw those lines.
I want to play another clip for you. This is also from our interview with Wayne LaPierre. We asked him if there's really a difference between a commercial entity whose primary product is mass media, like, for example, Viacom, and a nonprofit advocacy organization whose main goal is to influence policy.
I know some people say, well, wait a minute now. You guys give money to political candidates, and that makes you somehow different. I say back to that, well, wait just a minute here. Time Warner, which owns CNN, gave $5.1 million in the 2000 election cycle to politicians. Viacom, which owns CBS, gave $3.7 million. Disney, which owns ABC, gave $3.1 million. And News Corporation, which owns Fox, gave $1.6 million. So there's no difference.
He is right that these companies that own these other media outlets do, in fact, have a history of making political contributions. He left out Clear Channel. The owners of Clear Channel are big supporters of President Bush. Maybe at the end of the day, it doesn't make that much difference. The fact is they're all getting involved in the political process. There's no doubt the NRA has a view it's pushing, but that's true with a lot of different outlets. The question, though, is does it have the same credibility as some of these other outlets in the sense that it is only pushing one view? And that its political contributions really go only towards one view.
A satellite radio show is one thing. What happens if the NRA goes through with plans to actually start acquiring radio stations?
Well, on one hand, they actually may strengthen their argument that they fit under the media exemption. In this country, there's a long history of companies owning media outlets, and nobody claims there's a problem with that. So that actually, in some ways, may be their strongest way to go. They then definitely deal with a financial problem in terms of how much it costs to do that. I'm not sure how many groups can really go out there and afford to buy radio stations. However, I think if the NRA is successful at this, both legally and financially and politically, I have no doubt that you will see numerous corporations, trade associations, unions trying to do the same thing. And you will see very narrow casting in terms of ideological issues. And it does really run the risk of blowing a major hole in the McCain-Feingold law, unless there does seem to be some concept of media that we can all agree on or at least learn to live with.
All right, Larry. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Larry Noble is Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics.
The NRA has found one way to cut through the political message clutter, but the medium of choice this election season seems to be the political documentary. And the genre's heaviest hitter is Michael Moore, whose new film Fahrenheit 9/11 hits theaters Friday.
In the middle of the war, corporations decided to hold a conference to figure out how much money could be made.
Once that oil starts flowing, it's going to be lots of money. Whatever it costs, the government will pay you.
It's going to be good for business, bad for the people.
Fahrenheit 9/11, which includes some grisly footage from Iraq, grabbed headlines when the Walt Disney Company refused to release it. Miramax founders Bob and Harvey Weinstein defied its parent company, bought the film, and found a new distributor. This week, it made news again when the Motion Picture Association of America gave it an R rating, barring kids under the age of 17, some of whom might soon be serving in the military, from seeing it without mom and dad. Moore is appealing that rating. Meanwhile, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo said he would urge people to watch the film before they pick their next president.
How could Congress pass this Patriot Act without even reading it?
Sit down, my son. We don't read most of the bills.
No one read it.
Members of Congress, this is Michael Moore. I would like to read you the USA Patriot Act.
This is a potent piece of political advocacy, and one in a series of films with liberal messages ranging from John Sayles' Silver City, a satire about what one reviewer calls a grammatically challenged born-again candidate from a right-wing dynasty, to Tour of Duty, a look at John Kerry's service in Vietnam from the director of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Pumping Iron. Add to that Harry Thomason's just-released film about the political vendetta against Bill Clinton, The Hunting of the President, and you have what some conservatives suggest is a vast, suspiciously timed, left-wing cinematic conspiracy.
This is the inauguration reviewing
stand. Here is where Bill Clinton will make his oval office.
William Jefferson Clinton.
There was a sense in Washington that Clinton was not their kind of person.
Strategy was to use anything to inflict damage to his presidency.
All documentaries are made to influence opinion, and we hope this one does. But our opinion is not necessarily to affect the election. You have to understand, we thought we would have had this film out a year ago.
Director Harry Thomason says that the proliferation of documentaries arises partly from the public's growing acceptance of the genre. It's also a response, he says, to a growing suspicion that traditional journalism, pressed under the thumb of corporate ownership, is falling down on the job. As for the timing of this new wave of left-leaning films coming out on the eve of what will surely be a squeaker of a national election?
Actually, I think that all these films are coming out and it's strictly coincidental.
This isn't all coincidence because you do have individual filmmakers who do care about this election and they are turning to what they do best to try to have an impact.
And they could, says Rob Ritchie of the Nonpartisan Center for Voting and Democracy.
When, you know, almost half the adult population doesn't vote, if you can get more of those people to vote, you can tip a close election. What can also happen, though, is that, say, Republicans can point a finger at Hollywood and say, they're trying to steal this election again, those rich liberals that aren't like you, and get out and vote. You know, like, both sides are going to try to use such movies and the discussion about them to mobilize their base.
In fact, that's happening already. This month, Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly likened Michael Moore to Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels. Then he read a list of fellow brown shirts who showed up at a recent screening of Fahrenheit 9/11. Billy Crystal, Sharon Stone, Martin Sheen, Larry David, Chris Rock, Demi, and Ashton, the list goes on and on. NBC's Tom Brokaw and New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger Jr. were there too, but the New York Post reported that the applause lasted only half a minute, and many declined to stand for the ovation. Harry Thomason.
I think Michael Moore is a wonderful filmmaker, and I think if he thinks he's going to influence the election, then he's probably misinformed.
I'm sure it'll have some impact, and it's almost certainly not good for conservatives, Republicans like myself.
Richard Viguerie is an expert in the political use of alternative media.
Because the Hollywood media is not something that, you know, we're particularly well-versed in, and it's not one of our strong suits.
But according to Viguerie, new campaign laws limiting contributions have both sides scrambling for new outlets. Film, he says, can be used as a partisan megaphone, like, for instance, talk radio. Conservatives may own the microphone, but at the moment, liberals are running the cameras. And if ticket sales translate into votes...
I suspect Republicans will and conservatives will weigh in future years. People are looking for ways to have an impact without violating McCain-Feingold law, and this is an obvious way to do that. I think you're seeing the forerunner of a mass onslaught of documentaries that are just thinly veiled campaign pieces.
I don't believe at this moment that political documentaries that are being floated around are being used to evade the McCain-Feingold law.
Meredith McGeehee of the Alliance for Better Campaigns says that there is no evidence that people are funneling money into films as part of a coordinated effort to benefit a particular campaign. So despite reported grumblings from the GOP, there's no violation of the law.
It's the act of the coordination in itself that triggers any kind of limits. Being critical of a public official and having an intent to influence the outcome of a federal election actually are not exactly the same thing.
Michael Moore's film, I don't believe that 2 years ago when he started to make Fahrenheit 9/11, you know, that he was working on a film to support John Kerry. I think that he was making a film because he was really, really angry at what was happening in U.S. politics.
Stephen Rosenbaum is the director of Inside the Bubble, a documentary about the Kerry campaign's brain trust, currently slated for release after the election.
I don't understand why people get so concerned about the fact that Michael Moore has a point of view.
He says filmmakers have always wanted to tell stories that move people, and today the big story is political. It's just the technology that's changed. With digital video, they work cheaper and faster. And so they are. As for influence, who knows?
At this moment, we can say for sure that Michael Moore's film will make a big noise when it opens on the 25th. Beyond that film, though, I don't know of anything coming down the pike that is a slam dunk in terms of the ability to kind of rattle the windows. You forget how extraordinarily hard it is to get people to take their $9 out of their pocket and go to a movie theater and engage something serious and potentially a little hard to stomach.
So maybe it ends with more, but probably not. Rosenbaum says documentarians have always looked hard for funding, but depending on what happens in November, maybe the big campaign funders will come looking for them next time around. If they do, the watchdogs of campaign finance reform will be right behind them.
What if they made a documentary and nobody came? Well, until recently, that question wasn't merely a philosophical conundrum, it was market reality. Peter Biskind is the author of Down and Dirty, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film. He's here to tell us why that's all changed. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
So, documentaries have forever been the poor cousins among American films. You know, the part of the Oscar ceremonies where you run down to the kitchen and see what's in the fridge. Suddenly they're top of mind. What's happened?
Well, partly I think these things just go in cycles. I mean, if you look back to the 60s, that was probably the last golden age of documentaries where lots of documentary features would play in theaters. You know, all the rock concert films, films like Emile D'Antonio's Year of the Pig, a lot of the political films. Documentaries got a wide currency, and I think partly that was because of the immediacy of the historical changes that were taking place during that period, you know, the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and what was happening every day in reality and what was in front of you on camera was easily as interesting as fiction and what people were making up.
And there were the Maisels and there was D.A. Pennebaker, who were famous documentarians. But since then, there have been great and gifted filmmakers working in the documentary genre. Is it my imagination, or is it only now that Michael Moore has broken out that documentaries are getting attention and getting their due?
Well, I think Michael Moore deserves a lot of credit. I wouldn't totally attribute it to him. I mean, it's true that after the 60s was over, documentaries kind of disappeared. Part of that was the collapse of the NEA and NEH during the Reagan administration, where they cut the funds back and they were no longer giving out money for documentaries, so the money dried up. The other part of, I think, this was a sort of aesthetic fatigue with documentaries. In other words, people just got tired of the sort of conventional way that documentaries were made, where there's a droning voice essentially narrating the film and telling you what to think. Michael Moore personalized documentaries. You know, he told it in the first person. An important predecessor to Roger and Me was a film called Sherman's March by Ross McElwee that came out in the mid-80s. It was told in the first person. And I think both Moore and Ross injected entertainment values back into documentaries.
It seems to me that even if there were no documentary fatigue that had set in after the 60s, that there was such a limited number of places to see a documentary. But then there was an incredible phenomenon in the independent film business in the 80s, and that was called Miramax. Now if I want to go see a smart film, I don't have to go 30 miles to some dingy art house. I can go to my independent film multiplex 3 miles from my house. Don't documentarians have the explosion of the independent film business to credit for their distribution?
Yes, I think they certainly do. And there's a whole array of companies that contributed to this movement, but certainly Miramax played a major role. And one of the big contributions of Miramax was exactly, as you said, taking art films out of the art film ghetto and getting them into the multiplexes. And the key film and the key moment in this regard was 1989, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Miramax took that film and pushed it to a $25 million gross, which everyone thought was, like, you know, impossible. And they went on from there.
We talked about the fatigue with the 60s-style documentary and its didactic style, its omniscience. Do you think that we are in danger of heading towards fatigue of the highly personalized, kind of wry, funny, confrontational documentary that is Super Size Me and Fahrenheit 9/11?
Yes and no. I mean, I think eventually there'll be a backlash against that kind of documentary. I mean, I think there already is. But on the other hand, you have to look at the news context in which those documentaries appear. I mean, everywhere else you look, you have pseudo-objectivity on practically every single network and cable station, and the sort of cult of objectivity where you can't say A unless you dialectically confront it with B. the Moore films and the Moore way of making documentary is still unique and unusual enough that it'll be some time before people actually be. I mean, I think it's very refreshing still, and it's already, he's been doing it for like almost a decade.
All right, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Peter Biskin is the author of Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and The Rise of the Independent Film. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Vuolo, and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.